So I want you to think about this for a second. Back in October 2024, a single completely unedited podcast episode dropped online and generated like 26 million views in its first 24 hours.
Which is just a staggering number. I mean, it's hard to even wrap your head around.
Right. And there was no television network involved at all, no traditional news desk, no polished PR filters.
Nothing.
Just two guys sitting in a room with microphones talking. And today, for this deep dive, we're looking at the sort of invisible architecture that makes that kind of massive media dominance possible.
Yeah. And it really forces you to reevaluate what we even consider mass media today, to be honest, because structurally it just operates on completely different physics than anything that came before it.
Exactly. And that is our mission for today. We are deconstructing this massive strategic analysis. It was actually prepared today, June 13th, 2026, by American Newspaper and American TV.
Right. Brand new data.
Yeah. Fresh off the presses. And this report basically strips down the media power, the platform economics, and the cultural influence of the Joe Rogan Experience, or, you know, JRE.
Yeah.
But hey, just a really quick note to you, the listener, before we dive into all this. This report touches heavily on some very polarizing political events.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Debated health topics, highly controversial figures, you name it. And we want to be totally clear. We're strictly looking at the mechanics of this media machine today.
Right. The how, not the what.
Exactly. How the engine works, how it captures attention, regardless of who is driving the car, you know, what direction it's heading. We aren't endorsing any views here, and we're definitely not validating any controversies. We're staying totally neutral.
Yeah, I think that's super important to state up front. Our job here is just to look at the blueprints of the factory, right?
Yeah.
Not to review the actual products coming off the assembly line.
Perfect way to put it. So, okay, let's unpack this. To really grasp how this machine works, I think we need a sense of the sheer footprint first. Because Edison Research's Q1 2026 data, they rank JRE as the absolute number one U.S. podcast by reach. But the report argues that the superpower isn't actually the size of the audience, it's the method.
Right, the method of capturing them.
Because traditional media spent, what, decades training us to expect these hyper-compressed sound bites.
Yeah, exactly. 5-minute segments, a commercial break, and then a quick pivot to the weather.
Right, but why was it built like that?
Well, because traditional broadcasting was basically built on artificial scarcity. I mean, airtime on television or radio is incredibly expensive, right? So every single second is just aggressively managed and scripted.
Totally.
But JRE was built on the internet. And on the internet, airtime is infinite and, frankly, virtually free.
Mm-hmm.
So the strategic mechanism here is what the report called trust is attention.
Trust is attention. I like that.
Yeah. The show uses its grueling, you know, 3-hour long form format as a feature, not a bug. By removing the rigid script and just stretching the conversation out, listeners don't feel like they're being broadcast to. They feel like they're repeatedly entering a room and just hanging out with friends.
Which completely changes the tension, right? Think about it.
Yeah.
A traditional cable news interview feels like a highly supervised speed dating event.
Oh, totally. That's a great way to put it.
Everyone has prepared cue cards, they're sweating the clock, and they're basically just waiting to drop a pre-written zinger. But JRE, it feels like being stuck in an elevator for 3 hours with someone. Fascinating.
Right.
Because eventually the polished PR talking points, they just run out, the energy drops, and the real personality absolutely has to come out. But I have a question about that.
Sure.
Is that grueling length an intentional filter? Like, does forcing someone to listen for 3 hours weed out casual listeners just to forge a more intense, almost cult-like loyalty?
Well, what's fascinating here is that time itself functions as an authenticity generator.
Okay, how so?
Well, over the course of 3 hours, human beings simply cannot maintain a corporate facade. It's just too exhausting. So guests relax, they contradict themselves, they go off on these weird tangents, or, you know, they make off-color jokes.
Right, they slip up.
Exactly. And for the listener, that raw, unedited narrative arc is interpreted as inherently more truthful than a tightly edited, you know, flawless television interview.
Because if it's messy, it must be real.
Precisely. And then you pair that structural format with the host's actual persona. I mean, Rogan operates as this sort of cultural interface.
Yeah.
He combines the credibility of a stand-up comic, a UFC commentator, a fitness enthusiast, and crucially, a skeptical everyman.
Right. He's not wearing a suit.
Right. He isn't acting as an institutional gatekeeper. So he asks the naive, sometimes entirely unvetted or even taboo questions that a highly professionalized journalist would completely avoid out of concern for their, you know, professional reputation.
Which actually flatters the listener. It makes you feel respected, like you are actively participating in this informal sort of truth-seeking process alongside the host, rather than just being lectured by an authority figure.
Exactly.
But man, there is a massive operational challenge here.
Oh, for sure.
Because building deep trust through a 3-hour conversation is incredibly effective.
Yeah.
Yes. But how do you scale that? I mean, if you do hundreds of episodes without changing the format, shouldn't it get incredibly stale?
Well, it definitely would if the show relied on a single subject.
Mm.
But instead, it functions as this general purpose attention machine.
Okay, unpack that.
So the conversational container never changes, right? It's always just a relaxed chat in a studio. But the subjects pivot wildly. I mean, you might have an MMA fighter on Monday, an AI researcher on Wednesday, and then, you know, a deep dive into ancient civilizations, psychedelics, or even a presidential candidate by Friday.
And that casts a massive, but also a very specific net. Let's look at the data here. The October 2024 Edison Research audience profile from this report, the potential reach is roughly 80% male. Yeah, with 51% falling right in that highly coveted 18 to 34 age bracket. But politically, it's a total mixed bag.
Really?
Yeah, it's like 35% independent, 32% Republican, and 27% Democratic. And the report describes this using a term I actually found really interesting. They call it the male affinity stack.
Right, right. The affinity stack. It's essentially a cluster of overlapping cultural identities. So you have fitness, combat sports, stand-up comedy, self-optimization, entrepreneurship, and just a general flavor of outsider politics.
But wait, I need to push back on how that actually works in practice.
Okay, go ahead.
Because if I am a listener who tunes in purely because I want to optimize my diet, right? I want to hear from a fitness expert. Why don't I just immediately unsubscribe when the next 3 episodes are about, like, aliens or stand-up comedy mechanics? How does the stack actually hold conflicting demographics together without alienating the people who only care about one specific niche?
Because the underlying currency of the show isn't the specific topic at all. It's status. Yes, the show operates as a status platform. Every single time a high-profile guest appears, whether that's a billionaire tech CEO or a controversial comedian, it signals to other high-profile people that this is the premier venue to be seen.
I get it.
Right. Guests realize they can reach a massive audience, they get 3 hours to explain themselves without being constantly interrupted, and they face a much less adversarial environment than, say, a Sunday morning news show.
So the prestige of the guest list itself becomes the glue holding the whole audience together.
Exactly.
You might not care about quantum physics, but you tune in to the physicist because if they're on this specific show, they must be culturally relevant.
Right.
And that intense, undivided attention translates into a massive economic engine.
A staggering one, honestly. We really have to talk about the monetization of parasocial relationships.
Just define that for a second for the listener. Parasocial trust, meaning that completely one-sided psychological bond where a listener feels like they are genuine friends with the host, even though they've never actually met.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Just think about how you make purchasing decisions, right? If you see a highly polished commercial for a vitamin supplement on TV, your guard goes up. You know you're being sold to.
Yeah, obviously.
But if your buddy at the gym tells you he's been taking a new supplement and he feels great, you trust him. And the show's host read ads weaponize that exact dynamic. It is a direct commercial transfer of parasocial trust.
Which explains the massive scale of the podcast advertising industry right now. The report cites the Interactive Advertising Bureau, the IAB, noting that the U.S. podcast ad market hit, get this, $2.43 billion in 2024.
Yeah, billion with a B.
Right. And this show isn't just a participant in that market. It's practically the flagship asset in defining how host-read ad integration is supposed to work.
True, but that immense trust, combined with the total lack of traditional editorial oversight, creates a highly combustible environment.
Oh, right. Because when you have this incredibly loyal audience, a massive surface area of random topics, and 3 hours of completely unscripted conversation, unverified claims are basically guaranteed to slip through.
Guaranteed.
Now, in legacy media, a controversial, unverified claim slipping onto the air is a 5-alarm crisis. I mean, advertisers pull out, PR teams issue apologies, producers literally get fired. But the report points out that for JRE, controversy functions completely differently. It actually serves as fuel.
Yeah, and this is the paradox at the absolute core of the brand's architecture. The show is trusted by its fan base, specifically because it operates outside of institutional control.
Right.
But it is attacked by legacy institutions for that exact same reason. The total lack of traditional gatekeeping is what makes the show feel authentic, but it's also what makes it highly vulnerable to spreading questionable claims without any real expert pushback in the room.
And the ultimate stress test for this was the January 2022 COVID-19 and vaccine controversy. I mean, Neil Young literally pulled his entire music catalog off of Spotify. He publicly stated that the podcast was spreading false medical information.
Right. And that forced Spotify into a brutal position. I mean, they were caught right in the crossfire of this massive debate about platform responsibility.
Are they a tech pipe or a publisher, basically?
Exactly. Are they just a neutral technological pipe delivering audio, or are they a publisher responsible for the content of a show they have an exclusive deal with?
And their response was incredibly telling. They didn't remove the episodes.
Nope.
They added content advisories, sure, and they pointed listeners to an information hub. But their leadership explicitly stated they did not want to take the position of a, quote, content censor. It's like the controversy engine functions as a kind of immune system for the show.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah, I almost think of it like a mythological hydra. Every time critics or legacy institutions try to chop off a segment or demand something be removed, it triggers this massive defensive reflex from the fan base. It sprouts two new heads. It just generates massive media coverage and actually deepens listener loyalty.
Right.
But there has to be a ceiling to this, right? I mean, at what point does controversy stop acting as a viral growth engine and start becoming an actual brand safety hazard that alienates advertisers?
Well, that is the perpetual tightrope they walk. And what the report identifies is a really fascinating mechanism for survival during these crises. Factual disputes successfully mutate into status disputes.
Okay, wait, break that down for me. How does a factual dispute become a status dispute?
Okay, imagine a guest makes a highly controversial, scientifically unverified claim, right?
Yeah.
The legacy media attacks the fact. They bring on doctors to say, hey, this claim is mathematically and scientifically false. But the podcast's ecosystem instantly shifts the debate. The defense doesn't necessarily argue that the fact is true. Instead, the debate becomes, who are these elite institutions to tell us what we are allowed to talk about?
Oh, wow. So they completely change the battlefield. They make it about freedom of speech and anti-censorship rather than the actual accuracy of the original claim.
Exactly. And for the core fan base, these censorship debates reinforce their identity as outsiders. They view the institutional criticism not as a fact check, but as elite suppression. So paradoxically, the loyalty deepens.
Wow.
However, the report is explicitly clear that this structural dynamic introduces severe epistemic weakness into the broader culture.
Epistemic weakness, meaning the very foundation of how we determine what is true and what is false, starts to degrade.
Yeah.
Because if you have enough confidence, charisma, and just uninterrupted airtime, you can make a completely unverified claim sound incredibly plausible to millions of people. There's no one in the room to hit the pause button and say, wait, where did you get that statistic?
Exactly. And when that subjective reality is reinforced by millions of other listeners in the comments or on social media, the need for objective verification just sort of evaporates.
But relying on your existing loyal base to defend you during a crisis isn't enough to sustain growth long term. You can't just preach to the choir forever. You need massive platform infrastructure to constantly pull new people into the church.
Which leads us directly to the strategic evolution of the show's distribution.
Right, because it started out on the open web, right? Heavily utilizing YouTube. And then in 2020, Spotify locked them down in this massive exclusive deal.
Yeah, and that 2020 Spotify deal was a watershed moment for the entire audio industry. It fundamentally validated podcasting as premium intellectual property. It basically proved a podcast could be valued like a hit television franchise.
Yeah, nine figures, right.
Exactly. And it also helped define Spotify not just as a music app, but as a dominant video podcast platform.
But exclusivity is definitely a double-edged sword. I mean, you get a massive upfront payout, sure, but you sacrifice the open web. You completely lose that cross-platform discovery.
And crucially, exclusivity meant that every time a guest said something controversial on the show, it was no longer just an internet controversy, it was a Spotify corporate controversy.
Mm-hmm.
The tech platform had to constantly answer for the creator.
Which totally explains the massive strategic pivot in 2024.
Yes, exactly.
When the contract was renewed, they abandoned pure exclusivity. They pushed the show back out across multiple platforms, including a massive return to YouTube. And the video component here is absolutely central. The report cites Spotify data from June 2024 showing that over 170 million users had watched video podcasts on their platform.
Because video fundamentally changes the social mechanics of the audio.
Right.
If you're just listening to audio, it's an isolated experience.
Yeah.
But when you add video, you get facial reactions. You see the studio atmosphere. You see the host turn and interact with the producer off camera. These visual cues become highly shareable social objects.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense.
A single three-hour episode can be sliced into dozens of short, high-impact moments, perfectly engineered for TikTok, YouTube Shorts, X, and Instagram Reels.
I always think of those short-form social clips, like digital breadcrumbs or like billboards placed on highways that the podcast doesn't even own.
Oh, that's good.
They are just out there on the algorithmic internet grabbing attention, and their only function is to funnel people off that highway and back to the main three-hour destination. But here's what I don't quite get.
Okay.
If the show's absolute superpower is deep, nuanced, long-form context, doesn't carving it up into highly algorithmic 30-second clips actively undermine the core value? Aren't those out-of-context clips the exact things that spark the massive media controversies we just talked about?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture of the modern attention economy, we see that long-form and short-form media aren't enemies. They're actually strategic complements.
Yeah.
The 2024 multi-platform expansion proved a really harsh reality of the current internet. Even a flagship cultural juggernaut asset cannot survive purely on scarcity. It requires ubiquitous discovery. Yes, the short clips completely strip away context, and yes, the social media algorithms heavily favor outrage and high emotion spikes, but that outrage acts as a massive net.
The controversy essentially becomes the marketing budget.
Exactly. The short-form clicks capture fleeting attention. Even if someone clicks out of pure anger to see what the context was, a certain percentage of those scrollers will get pulled into the longer conversation, they'll calm down, and they'll convert into deeply loyal, long-form listeners.
Man, and here's where it gets really interesting to me. When you zoom out and combine all these elements, a ubiquitous cross-platform presence, an incredibly loyal young male demographic, a highly effective clip economy, and a conversational format fueled by anti-elite sentiment, the show actually transcends mere entertainment. The report argues it has effectively become a substitute institution, an alternative public square.
And that transformation is only possible because of the broader macro environment of institutional distrust in America right now.
Oh, yeah.
The report brings in some frankly brutal metrics regarding how the public views legacy media. A Gallup poll from October 2025 found that only 28% of U.S. adults trust mass media to report the news fully, accurately, and fairly.
Just 28%? That is wild.
It gets worse. A Pew Research study from February 2026 found that 57% of adults have low confidence in journalists to act in the public's best interests.
When over half the country actively distrusts the traditional arbiters of information, it creates a massive cultural vacuum. And this show steps right into that void, functioning as a highly efficient, low-friction persuasion zone for political actors.
Absolutely.
Think about it. If you were running for high office, this show provides three uninterrupted hours of direct access to a huge audience that is entirely tuning out the nightly news or conventional debate stages. It sounds like JRE isn't just reporting on the culture war. It's providing the actual stadium for it to be played in.
Yeah, and the numbers are staggering. The report notes that Donald Trump's October 2024 appearance on the podcast racked up 26 million YouTube views in its first 24 hours alone.
That kind of metric elevates the podcast from a successful entertainment product to literal campaign infrastructure.
Completely.
But when a politician sits down in that studio for 3 hours, are they just buying a massive audience, or are they doing something deeper? Are they literally borrowing the host's parasocial trust to completely bypass the critical defense mechanisms of the voter? Because it feels like they aren't engaging in a political interview. They're just, you know, hanging out with your buddy.
This raises an important question about the evolving nature of political authority. Political actors are absolutely borrowing creator legitimacy. A show like this doesn't need to issue formal endorsements or operate with a strict ideological manifesto to wield immense political power. It wields power simply by setting the agenda. It decides which questions are considered legitimate to ask, which outsider experts are granted a platform, and crucially, who gets to be humanized in front of tens of millions of people.
It redefines what an interview even is.
Exactly. The traditional news anchor wielded authority through institutional prestige, right? The soup, the desk, the network lodo. The new authority is wielded entirely through perceived authenticity.
Okay, so what does this all mean for you, the listener, navigating this landscape? We've covered the mechanics of a massive cultural engine today, and the report outlines numerous strategic perspectives, but let me boil down the core mechanical takeaways. First, in an era of deep skepticism, trust is the absolute most lucrative business model on Earth.
Without a doubt.
Second, authentic, unscripted duration just leaving the mics on for 3 hours builds far deeper loyalty than polished, compressed brevity. And finally, a strong host persona isn't just about entertainment. It operates as a multi-tool. It's a distribution hook to pull people in and a controversy shield that literally mutates factual attacks into freedom of speech defenses.
Yeah, and for anyone listening today, whether you are trying to understand the shifting media landscape, figuring out how modern political persuasion actually works, or just trying to navigate an internet dominated by algorithms, recognizing these mechanics is essential.
Absolutely.
Intimacy as influence is the new playbook.
Yeah.
However, the report's ultimate warning remains incredibly stark. Scaling authenticity without applying any editorial discipline creates massive social vulnerabilities.
You can't just copy the studio aesthetic, put two chairs in a room, and turn on the cameras without understanding the fragile trust dynamics underneath it all, which leaves us with something to really chew on as you go about your day. If raw, unedited, parasocial conversations are actively replacing polished institutional news for millions of people, what happens to our shared reality? What happens when every citizen retreats into their own deeply trusted but entirely subjective alternative public square?
It's a big question.
Are we still sharing an elevator as a society, or are we just riding in completely different buildings, wondering why we can't hear each other? Keep asking questions, keep looking for the hidden blueprints, and never stop analyzing the mechanics behind the media you consume.